Okay, ready to dive deep. This time, we're getting into some heavy stuff going right into the brain. Specifically, what happens when it dies? Listeners always have questions about this one, the neuroscience of death, near-death experiences, all that.
It's the ultimate frontier, isn't it? Where does life end? What comes after, if anything? And the research is changing so fast, we're getting a totally new understanding of those final moments.
So our sources this time, some really fascinating studies that suggest the brain doesn't die like flipping a switch. It's not instant, right?
Right. It's more like, unfortunately, a chain reaction. And the big domino that starts the whole thing falling apart is oxygen. Well, the lack of it, to be precise.
Makes sense. Our brains use up a ton of oxygen, right? But how does that lack of oxygen actually kill the brain? What's the process?
Energy, or rather, no energy. See, without oxygen, the brain can't produce the energy it needs to, well, do anything, like a total power outage, but for your brain cells. And that's when things get really bad because the energy depletion, it triggers this cascade of failures one after another until the brain just can't recover.
So it's not like instant death. There's a whole timeline of damage that happens.
Yes, exactly. Within just 4 to 10 minutes after the blood stops flowing, you're already in a critical situation, an energy crisis for the brain. The balance inside your brain cells goes completely haywire, ionic imbalances, meaning those electrical signals, they can't fire off like they should. And then inflammation, swelling, the cells start breaking down. It's not pretty.
So at that point, the brain is fighting a losing battle, basically.
It's really tough to come back from that. And that's where those brainwave readings get really interesting, the EEG.
Right, the EEG, those brainwaves. What are they actually showing as someone's dying?
Often there's a decrease in overall activity leading up to death, you know, like things are slowing down. But here's where it gets kind of wild. Some studies show an actual surge in gamma
I
waves.
mean, gamma waves, those are the ones linked to, like consciousness, focus, all that good stuff. What's going on there?
$1 million question. It's like the brain is trying one last time to reboot the system, this last burst of activity before the end. Some researchers even think it could be connected to those memories people report in near-death experiences, their whole life flashing before their eyes.
So you're saying our brains might actually be wired to do that?
It's a real possibility. And it gets weirder because at the exact moment of death, some studies show a massive gamma wave surge, even more connected and intense than the one before. It's like a final, I don't know, the last gasp of something.
So you have this decrease, then a surge, then a huge E surge, and then what? Is that it? Game over?
That usually leads to the EEG going completely silent. Flatlining, as they call it, meaning no more detectable electrical activity. It's the classic sign of brain death.
So that's really it. No coming back from the flat line.
It's generally considered irreversible, yeah. But, and this is where it gets really wild, there's new research suggesting a tiny window, like really tiny, right after flatlining, where if oxygen could be restored incredibly fast, resuscitation might be possible. They're calling it a wave of resuscitation, like a final opportunity for the brain to kickstart itself.
A wave of resuscitation.
Yeah.
So even after the flatline, there might be this tiny chance that totally changes how we think about death.
It makes you question everything, doesn't it? And that leads us perfectly into those cases where people do come back, those who've had near-death experiences. What's going on in their brains? Could it be related to those gamma waves, or is it something else entirely?
It's incredible to think there might even be like a tiny chance of reviving someone after they flatline. But what about the people who DO come back? You know, those who've had near-death experiences. What's actually happening in their brains?
Well, it's like where the hard science, the stuff we can measure, meets these really intense, almost spiritual experiences, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's so fascinating is that there might actually be some overlap between like what people describe happening and what neuroscience is starting to understand about the brain.
That's what makes this whole thing so exciting. So, okay, let's break down those classic near-death experience elements, the things people consistently report, and see if we can make sense of them.
Perfect. So, what are some of the hallmarks? What do people usually say when they're describing an NDE?
Well, a lot of people talk about this incredible feeling of peace, often with an out-of-body sensation, like they're floating, watching everything from above. And then there's that tunnel vision, sometimes a bright light at the end, maybe the whole life flashing before their eyes. Some even describe seeing loved ones who've passed away.
It's amazing, though, because like you said, some of it might actually have a biological explanation. The science seems to line up with these really out there stories.
It's true. It's not as mystical as it seems at first glance. Take that feeling of peace, for example. Turns out when your brain is under extreme stress, like when it's not getting enough oxygen, it releases a flood of endorphins.
Right. Endorphins, those are like our natural painkillers, right? Yeah. Those feel-good chemicals.
Exactly. It's like the brain's way of easing the pain, going into survival mode. And that could explain why people report having these really pleasant, even euphoric experiences during an NDE. Then there are the out-of-body sensations, which are, well, really strange to think about.
Yeah. How do you even explain that?
Well, research suggests that disruptions in a particular brain area, the temporoparietal junction, TPJ for short, could be the culprit.
Okay, hold on. Back up a little, TPJ. What's that?
Yeah.
And how does it make someone feel like they're outside their own body?
Okay, so think of the TPJ like your brain's internal GPS system. Mm-hmm. It creates your sense of self, where you are in space, and the boundaries of your body. But when the TPJ isn't working right, like when you're really stressed or deprived of oxygen, that sense of self can get all messed up.
So it's like your brain's GPS is glitching out, and suddenly you don't know where you end and the world begins.
Exactly. And that messed up sense of self fits perfectly with those descriptions of floating above yourself, looking down, and seeing your own body. Then we've got the tunnel vision, the light at the end of the tunnel, super common in NDEs.
Yeah, like you're moving towards this light. What's the science on that one?
Remember how important oxygen is for the brain? Well, one of the areas that's most sensitive to a lack of oxygen is the visual cortex, the part of your brain that processes everything you see.
So if there's not enough oxygen, your vision center starts to freak out a little.
Basically, yeah. And that can cause tunnel vision, things getting blurry, or even seeing a bright light as the neurons misfire.
Right.
It's the same reason you might see stars if you hit your head really hard. It's all about disruptions in how your brain normally processes what you see.
Okay, that makes sense. So we've got some leads on the peacefulness, the out-of-body part, the tunnel vision. But what about the stuff that's really hard to explain, like when people report seeing or hearing things they shouldn't be able to because of where they are physically?
Ah, you're talking about what we call veridical perception. When someone having an OBE describes something that turns out to be accurate, something they wouldn't have known through their normal senses.
Exactly. Like describing things happening in other rooms or details about their surroundings that they couldn't possibly have seen. How do you even begin to explain that?
It's one of the biggest head scratchers in all this, for sure. There are a bunch of theories, some more out there than others, ranging from pretty conventional to, well, let's just say less conventional. Some researchers believe it could be evidence of ESP, extrasensory perception, you know, where consciousness is somehow operating outside the limits of the brain and body.
So, like, the mind actually separating from the body and going somewhere else.
That's the idea. Others suggest it might involve tapping into some kind of universal information field, a concept you often hear about in quantum physics where everything is interconnected. It's pretty wild stuff.
Okay, that one's definitely on the more speculative side. Are there any more, let's say, grounded explanations for this veridical perception thing?
Of course. One possibility is something called cryptomnesia.
Cryptomnesia. Sounds familiar. Remind me what that is.
It's basically unconscious memory access. So it's possible that someone is subconsciously picking up on information, maybe overhearing a conversation or noticing a small detail without realizing it, you know. And then later during the NDE, these hidden memories resurface and the brain sort of weaves them into the whole experience.
So it's like those times when you remember something out of nowhere, something you didn't even know you knew.
Exactly. Except in this case, it creates the illusion that the information came from some outside source when it was actually buried in their subconscious all along. Another theory is suggestibility, which can be surprisingly powerful.
Suggestibility. How does that work with NDEs?
Well, when people are in these heightened states of awareness, especially if they're on medication or under intense stress, they become way more open to suggestion. So let's say a doctor or nurse mentions something in passing. The person having the NDE might unconsciously latch onto that and make it part of their experience, even if they don't remember actually hearing it.
Ah, so it's kind of like being hypnotized, where the power of suggestion can really influence what you experience.
Precisely. And this could explain some instances of veridical perception where the information actually didn't come from some paranormal source, but was just a result of suggestibility and how the brain processes things unconsciously.
So even those seemingly impossible cases where people know things they shouldn't, there could be these perfectly normal psychological or neurological explanations.
Yeah.
But it gets even weirder, right? Because I've heard that scientists can actually create out-of-body experiences in the lab. Is that true?
You heard right. Remember that temporoparietal junction we were talking about, the TPJ? Well, it turns out that by stimulating that area, researchers can actually induce OBE-like sensations in patients.
No way. So they can actually make someone feel like they're floating outside their body just by stimulating their brain? How is that even possible? It's just wild to me that we can create an experience like that, an out-of-body experience, just by messing with the brain a little. Makes you wonder what's real, you know? And it all comes back to consciousness. What even I asked that?
Ah, consciousness, the biggest mystery of all, right? And like everything we've been talking about, there's not exactly a simple answer.
Well, you've definitely got my attention now. So what is it, as far as we know? How do you even define consciousness?
It's a tough one, that's for sure. I mean, at its heart, consciousness is about awareness, being aware of yourself, the world around you, your thoughts, your feelings. It's what makes you you, right? But the thing is, it's also incredibly subjective.
Meaning what you experience as consciousness, it's going to be different from what I experience.
Yeah, exactly. And there's no way for us to directly access or measure that difference. We can't get inside someone else's head and really know what it's like to be them.
So how can scientists even study something so intangible?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we can look at brain waves, but those are just electrical signals. How do you go from that to understanding what it actually feels like to be a conscious person?
That's the million-dollar question. And it gets into something called the hard problem of consciousness. It's not just about figuring out which parts of the brain light up when we're conscious, but it's about understanding how all that activity, those neurons firing, actually create the experience of being conscious. Like, how do those physical processes become the feeling of seeing the color red or tasting chocolate or, I don't know, feeling love? How do you get from point A to point B?
So it's like we can see the orchestra, all the instruments, we can even see them playing, but we have no idea how that becomes the music we're hearing.
Now you're getting it. And that's why this whole field of consciousness research is so incredibly challenging. The brain is ridiculously complex to begin with. Plus, the tools and methods we have now, they only give us a very limited view. We can see the activity, but we're a long way from really getting it, you know?
Okay, so where do we go from here? Any promising research that might help solve this hard problem?
Oh, absolutely. Researchers are trying all sorts of crazy things. Some are looking at the role of quantum mechanics. Others think consciousness might be a fundamental property of the universe itself. But one of the more interesting areas is comparing different states of consciousness, sleep, anesthesia, and yeah, even death.
Okay, that makes sense. By looking at how the brain acts or doesn't in those different states,
mm-hmm.
we might learn something about what it takes for consciousness to exist in the first place.
Exactly, like with sleep, for example. We know the brain goes through all these different stages, each with its own unique brainwave patterns. Some stages you lose consciousness completely, and then you've got dreaming, which is a whole other thing, vivid experiences, even if we don't always remember them.
So is sleep kind of like a mini death for the brain then?
Not quite. While they both involve some brain functions shutting down, there's one big difference. Sleep is thankfully reversible, right? You wake up. But by studying the brain activity in each state, researchers can start to figure out which brain patterns are linked to consciousness, which ones are linked to dreaming, and which ones mean there's just nothing there.
So we're studying what happens when consciousness fades to try and understand what it means to be conscious. Kind of backward, but I get it.
It's like trying to understand how a game works by watching what happens when everyone takes a break. Right, when the game's paused, when it's over, you can start to piece together the rules by looking at what's not happening too.
This whole thing has been mind-blowing, honestly. We've covered so much ground, how the brain dies, near-death experiences, the mysteries of consciousness.
And we're just getting started. There's so much more to discover.
That's what makes it so exciting, right?
Yay.
And hopefully for our listeners out there, this deep dive's given you a few things to think about too. Like, if there's a possibility of that wave of resuscitation after the brain seems dead, does that change how you view death? Does it make those stories of near-death experiences, of consciousness leaving the body, a little more believable? It seems like even when it comes to death, the brain is the final frontier. Thanks for going on this journey with us.